This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And every night, we like to tell you stories about every walk and every aspect of American life, from business and commerce to art, music, love, death, and father and son relationships, mother-daughter, father-daughter, and mother-son. We love bringing those relationships to the front and center of our program, because in the end, the greatest, greatest social institution ever invented was called the family. And so we love talking to folks who talk about such things. And in the Wall Street Journal, not long ago, the really great writer Keith Blanchard, well, he had a fishing story that he wrote for the Journal that was really, really a great father-son story. We gave him a buzz, asked him to record it for us. And here it is right now, Keith's story about a trip he took to Mexico to catch fish with Pop.
Among the most beautiful words in the English language are certainly home and family. Bacon is a contender, too, in some circles. But to sports fishermen, no words are more beautiful than fish on, an adrenaline-fueled exclamation that they shout across the back of a boat when something has at last found its way to their hooks. I've been deep-sea fishing since I was too small to remember. My dad, my grandfather, and I would steam out at least a couple of times each summer from Barnegat on the Jersey Shore in my grandfather's 40-foot fishing boat, Sea Doll. My grandfather was always on the hunt for a trophy sailfish, back when the sea was still thick with such things. And he and my father had fished all the way out on the continental shelf for years, staying overnight and sleeping in shifts so they wouldn't be run down by freighters. But when I came along, they stayed responsibly closer to shore, hunting striped bass and settling, sometimes, for the much maligned Atlantic bluefish. These were all sea monsters to the preteen version of me, with their slack jaws and unblinking eyes, flipping over and over on the deck and skidding and slip-sliding into the hold. I'll never forget the raw anticipation I felt when our boat slipped free from the dock in the early morning when it was still dark, foam churning behind us to the thrum of the motor as we pushed North America away behind us. But kids grow up, and life moves on. My grandfather passed away, his boat was sold, and over time I kind of lost touch with both my old man and the sea. And so, decades later, right around the time I turned 40, I decided to stop thinking about it and to organize a father-son fishing trip. It took my dad about 3 seconds to say yes. And what would we fish for? Well, the ocean is filled with wonders. But deepwater fishermen all share one bucket list catch, the marlin, king of the sea. And so my dad and I, with my good friend Roddy, an experienced marlin hunter, found ourselves motoring out past the chalky crags of Baja California's Pacific coast, 3,000 miles and a world away from New Jersey's Barnegat Bay, on the first day of a 3-day fishing trip. Out of the ghostly marina at dawn and into the cold, dewy air of the Pacific. With the ceremonial first beer a little later, we drank a toast to my grandfather, and Roddy gave us the brief. A cross between a shark, a unicorn, and a freight train, marlins often weigh more than 200 pounds, though some monsters are much heavier, and can swim as fast as a car, leaping majestically out of the water when trying to throw a hook. And they're Neptune's own serial killers, eating anything they can smack and stun with that bone-hard bill. They're also smart and worthy opponents that work hard to stay out of your boat, thrashing and slicing at your line with their bills, even fouling your lines by swimming under the hull. Hauling one can take an hour, sometimes much more, of focused work. Your job is to keep that rod bent, reeling in the line when the fish will let you. A few hours in, we lucked out. Fish on! My dad slid into the fighting chair, set the pole, and started winding away. At several points, I jokingly offered to take a shift, but he just growled and continued his determined struggle, ultimately reeling in a nice one, 160 pounds and almost 7 feet long from the tip of the bill to the fork in its tail. We took our proof of triumph photos and released the fish to help keep the population healthy. Later, we celebrated at a bar, where I became acquainted with the awkward feeling of drinking with one's father while busty waitresses wearing Pancho Villa-style shot glass bandoliers trot around pushing drinks. I was ready to hook my own trophy, but the second day was more like a nature cruise than a fishing expedition. We saw dolphins and sea turtles and two whales that surfaced together right in front of our boat. Our only fish-on moment came when Roddy hooked a hump-headed, bottle-green mahi-mahi. Back to shore we went to eat our humble, delicious catch of the day. Our third and last day broke cold and overcast. Good fishing weather. The hours ticked by with all of us staring hopefully at the end of the rods, but we just couldn't will that telltale bounce into being. By the time we turned for home, I was at peace with it. A bad day's fishing is still better than a good day at work, right? Then, suddenly, just as we were about to pull up the lines, fish on! I scrambled into the chair and focused hard while my proud dad snapped photos like a maniac. And then the sharks arrived, circling the boat in anticipation of what we were about to reel in. Sharks love marlin, especially when humans have helpfully hooked them. The boat's crew bravely, or was it insanely, leaned over the stern and smacked one away with a bat and pulled another out of the way with the hook of a long-handled gaff. My muscles were in agony and my reeling hand blistered up. I was functioning on pure adrenaline, feeling every inch a soft and pudgy city kid. At one point, my prize leapt out of the water and flashed me those beautiful stripes. Would this marlin be that coveted middle line for my tombstone? Born, caught marlin, died? Or the dreaded one that got away? Today, my marlin, a fiberglass replica of it actually, hangs on my office wall. My dad's replica hangs in his house. Mine was slightly smaller than his, as he will remind you again and again if you let him. Every time that giant memento inspires questions and I get to tell my story, our story, I picture my dad doing the same thing, and it brings a smile. A bad day of fishing beats a good day at work, but a good day of fishing beats almost anything at all.
What a great read. Thank you, Keith Blanchard. And thank you to every dad who takes his kid fishing, who takes his kid to the theater, to church, just out to throw a ball, a picnic, whatever. Fathers need their sons, daughters need their fathers too, and we talk about that here on Our American Stories, and we will not stop talking about it. And if you're lapsing on this, get to work, dads. Work's important, but a good day fishing is better than anything. And even a bad day's fishing, as we learn from Keith and his wise father, is better than even a great day at work. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. You can catch this and all of our stories on OurAmericanNetwork.org. And go to the Wall Street Journal and subscribe. It's America's best paper, filled with stuff like this each and every day. Beyond a doubt.
We'll be beyond the sea, and never again I'll go sailing.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we've got another really good one. Earlier today, we spoke with Biar Atem, one of the Lost Boys of Sudan, a group of very young boys from the South Sudan who were forced to flee their home without their parents when Islamic militants in North Sudan violently attacked their villages. These Islamists had an intentional and unthinkable strategy to kill off all the young boys so that they wouldn't have to fight them or face them when they became adults. Despicable. Biar was one of the few lucky ones who made it out of that human wreckage. Out of 30,000 lost boys, only 11,000 survived. The rest were killed by militants and by the wild itself, mostly lions and crocodiles. A whole 13 years later, Biar was granted refugee status by our country and found his American dream in, of all places, Las Vegas. Working his way up in the Las Vegas Sands Hotel, from being a janitor to now serving as the assistant manager of in-suite dining at their Venetian and Palazzo hotels. When we spoke with Biar, he first told us about the instantaneous life-or-death decision he had to make at 7 years old on whether to leave everything behind when his village was first under attack.
So when that happened, I knew there was really no time for me to go back home because the villages were bombed. And I had no place to go, so the best thing for me to do was just run away. And I remember I was so afraid that I had no idea where I was going, so I just kept running, and I left the cattle. And that's when I found the rest of the Lost Boys, too, and we kept working as a group. I thought I was going to come back home anyway that night, and as a 70-year-old boy, you really couldn't think of much. I thought it was just going to the next next village to hide and then be able to come back home, but there's really no home to come back to. And that's what I had going on in my mind. I thought it was just going to be, you know, I was going to be gone for a few hours and then come back later, but that didn't happen.
The oldest in their group was 11 years old. Their leader, imagine that. And the journey to Ethiopia by foot was brutal for such young men, and they would go often days without food. VR tells about a second life or death decision he had to make.
I must have gone for 2 days without food, and then there was time when I felt that that was it for me. I couldn't really go. I was so tired. I had no shoes. So I was like, you know what, I'm just going to sit and just, you know, not go anymore. So my cousin at the time, it was about maybe 500 feet ahead of me, so he stopped and called me. So I ran and I said, BR, take a look at this one. And what it was referring to, that was just a dead body, a young boy who happened to die. So he said, if you don't keep walking, you're going to be left behind just like that little boy right there. So that was my motivation to keep walking. And I don't know where I found the energy, but since that time, I was never left behind in the group. I was running. I felt like I didn't weigh anything really, because I think that happened when you're afraid, you know, of your life. So I just kept walking until I made it to Ethiopia.
VR would make it to Ethiopia and found relative stability there, but it too would be taken over by militants who gave them an ultimatum: leave in 72 hours or we'll kill you. So BR and his group of lost boys had no choice but to go back into Sudan and risk attack by the same Islamist who tried to kill them in the first place. In order to make their way to Kenya, BR would make it, and a whole 13 years after his original fleeing, Catholic Charity sponsored him for refugee status by our country, and he was placed again in Las Vegas.
When I was resettled to the U.S. to Las Vegas in 2001, after spending 9 years in a refugee camp in Kenya, to me, I didn't believe that I was coming to the U.S. until I actually landed in Las Vegas. So when I get to Las Vegas, it was about 10:30 at night, and then for many people who have been to Las Vegas, they'll know what I'm talking about. The light, it was just so bright and amazing, something that I've never seen in my life before. And as a plane landed and got on the bus to go to my apartment, and it was just, I couldn't believe that I was going to be doing some of the things that I'm doing right now, and let alone that I didn't think I was going to be able to drive, and everything was just so unreal. It was just so different from what I've known in my life.
VR was given $300 in refugee assistance by our government, but he had a much larger goal in mind: to become self-sufficient.
The $300 that was given to me for my rent, and of course with $300 you cannot really afford to get even a studio apartment, so it was me and two other lost boys in a two-bedroom apartment. What I knew that I had to do, I had to get a job right away and support myself and help the other lost boys who didn't get a chance to come to the U.S. So a month after I came to the U.S., I got a job right away at the Venetian Casino Resort in Las Vegas. So a total of 11 lost boys. So when we were employed, we worked so hard that the company was like, you know, we need more lost boys. We need more people like you guys. And coming from a refugee camp where there was no job opportunities, really, you can do more after getting a high school diploma. There were no other opportunities in the camp. So we knew that we had to work hard in order to be able to make it or succeed in the U.S.
So many Americans were there for BR: America itself, Catholic Charities, the Las Vegas Sands, who employed him at their Venetian resort. But there was one person in particular that BR made a point to talk to us about.
In the Sands organization, one of the people that became more than a mentor to the Lost Boys was Michael Levin. He was the president and CEO at the time. And Mr. Levin used to invite the Lost Boys to just go, you know, have breakfast with them, go hang out and talk about what we went through in his office. You know, I just don't have the word to describe that, but it's something that we're really so thankful for, like being able to give us some advice on how to move up within the corporate world and the opportunities that we didn't have. It's really so good when you have somebody like Mike Levin taking you under his wing and saying, okay, give you some advice. This is what you do, you know, in terms of development, personal development. So it's something that I just don't have the word to describe, but we're so thankful for, you know, for taking the time and developing that relationship with the Lost Boys.
That's a story you're not going to hear many places, folks. President and COO of a large national company, a multinational company, taking the time not only to mentor a Lost Boy, but to just eat with them and share meals with them and fellowship with them. Bjar had found great opportunity at the Sands thanks to his hard work and Mike Levin's mentorship, working his way up from janitor to now serving as the assistant manager of in-suite dining. He has lived the American dream, and yet Bjar's definition of it is much more profound.
Well, my definition of American dream that you just described, to me, you can really do anything here in the U.S., like getting educated, getting a house, and then having a family. But what really means a lot to be an American is to be able to give back to the community. And what inspired me is like that when a natural disaster happened elsewhere in the world, let's say in the Philippines, a typhoon or something like that, the United States is always the first country to go there and help those people who are not able to help themselves. So as an American, it's more than just doing good things for yourself. It's about being able to give back to the community when you have the means to do so, and that's what my American dream is.
Well, black lives do matter, and they matter to Mike Levin. And the American dream, as this young man is telling everybody in this country who has ears to hear, the American dream is alive and well. From Bjar's first paycheck as a janitor to today, he has been sending large portions of paychecks to the Lost Boys who weren't as fortunate as he to make it to America. He has said, quote, "You have to understand, for many Lost Boys, we're the only family they have. So I sent what I could. I couldn't forget them." Recently, Bjar decided to take it a step further and open the South Sudan Center of America.
What I wanted to do with a nonprofit is kind of like my way of giving back to the community, being able to raise some money and offer a scholarship for the Lost Boys who didn't get the opportunity to come to the U.S. And it's also an opportunity to get the Lost Boys to get in their communities here in the U.S. and then get to talk about their stories in the schools and be able to motivate young people and give them a different perspective about life, that if they think that they're going through, you know, that they have a lot of problems and challenges, they're going to have to wait and hear our story and then see if they'll complain after that. So just we want to be able to give people a different perspective that he can do it. It doesn't matter whether you start out as a Lost Boy or came here with nothing. But for those who are so fortunate to be born here, in America, you can accomplish anything. You just have to work hard for it, really. It doesn't matter. You can be born poor in the U.S. and then die rich. And so I feel that it's my responsibility and my duty to be able to get in the community and be able to give people a different perspective about life.
That's Bjar Atim and a Lost Boy teaching America about America. We'll be back after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is our Bring Small Businesses Back segment brought to you by Job Creators Network. And we're going to be talking with these fellas and gals often over the next year, because what they're doing is representing small business owners and their struggles in this great country. And we wanted to talk today with a woman in Mississippi who, well, she's been involved in a remarkable struggle for small business owners in her own state and throughout the country. She's an African-American woman from Tupelo, Mississippi, a mere 45-minute drive from our studio here in Oxford, a woman who knows way too much about a subject we're about to talk about, licensing. And you're thinking, licensing, why are you talking about licensing? Well, wait till you hear this story. Because it got in the way of her American dream and so many women like her. Her name Melanie Armstrong.
My name is Melanie Armstrong. Every day, hundreds of low-income families are housed because of my work, but I don't run a shelter. They are clothed through what I've done, but I don't run a secondhand clothing store. They are fed because of what I achieve, but I don't run a soup kitchen. I've transformed the lives of hundreds of poor women in my state of Mississippi, not because I sought out government assistance, rather because I asked the government to get out of my way.
That's a piece that Melanie did with the remarkable warriors at the Institute for Justice who helped her with her great struggle. And Melanie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Melanie, you gave some powerful testimony before the U.S. Congress. You're joining us on our show. What is your line of work, and what were these licensing requirements from your own state of Mississippi that got in your way and in the ways of other women who wanted to practice in this trade of yours?
Sure. So I am the owner of Naturally Speaking. It's a natural hair care and braiding salon. And we're located in Tupelo. We've been open since 1999. And when not long after I opened, being the only braiding salon in my area and actually the only, the first professional licensed braiding salon in the state of Mississippi, business began to boom. And after business took off, I began to have young ladies coming to me and wanting to work in the salon. They wanted me to train them in the craft of hair braiding and then work in the salon. And at that time, like a lot of entrepreneurs, I was wanting to basically expand my business, expand my dream, and I quickly realized that I wasn't going to be able to do that because the state required anyone practicing natural hair care and braiding to have a 1,500-hour cosmetology license.
And Melanie, 1,500 hours meant what to you financially, and what did it mean to your business?
Well, first, financially, it meant about, at that time, about $12,000 to $15,000. And also, it meant taking about a year and a half out of my schedule to go to cosmetology school full time. And that just seemed senseless at the time. Here I am, I already have a business that I've been running. And so why should I have to take that much time and spend that much money to go and take a course that's going to teach me nothing about what I, you know, what I'm interested in doing?
Well, now tell me this, you run across this wall. Who's behind it? Who's trying to make you suddenly pass all these licensing tests? You've been doing this for a long time. The customers weren't complaining. Where did it come from, Melanie? Where was this assault on your life, your business? Where was it coming from?
So you have groups. So in this case, it was the Mississippi State Board of Cosmetology who were actually behind it. The regulations were, this is where the regulations actually were instituted through the state board, Mississippi State Board of Cosmetology, to get our legislators to pass laws that would regulate this industry.
Well, it turns out hair braiding doesn't include chemicals, Melanie, or cutting hair. It's all natural. And it turns out women in ancient Egypt were safely doing this 5,000 years ago without a license. So what did you
exactly.
do? What did you do next, Melanie? What was your next step? What did you do?
So my next step was I actually got hooked up with the Institute for Justice. I call them IJ. And they researched, they did some research in our state, in the state of Mississippi, and found out that basically my constitutional rights were being violated. I was being prevented from making an honest living. And so at that point, I felt that I had no choice but to file a lawsuit against the State Board of Cosmetology.
And we saw you testify with gripping storytelling. What happened next? The audience is just, I think, sitting on the edge of their seat. Here's an individual woman challenging the Mississippi State Board and ultimately taking her case to the courts and to the state legislature. What happens next, Melanie?
Well, what happened next is we were winning our case in court, and at that time, the Mississippi State Board of Cosmetology introduced a bill into the state Senate. And so we had to, my attorney and I, we had to make a decision at that point in order to pursue the bill that they had introduced. That meant that we would have to drop our lawsuit in order to now lobby, basically counter-lobby what they had introduced. So that's what we did, and we actually introduced our own bill. And that bill was successfully lobbied, and it resulted in the law being passed that no longer regulates hair braiders or natural hair care stylists.
And, you know, in the end, what you did was, well, free all hair braiders from the $15,000 to $30,000 fee and all the loss of income, and you got it reduced, Melanie, you're being so humble, to a mere $25 registration fee with the Board of Health. So how did that feel, you know, ultimately speaking truth to power, as the saying goes?
Yes, it feels very great. You know, it does feel very, it's very humbling. And I've had the privilege of being able to train many of the young women that are now registered as hair braiders. The last time I checked in our state, over 3,000 women are now registered as hair braiders, and many of them are first-time business owners and entrepreneurs.
Well, Melanie, thanks so much for joining us. We're in Mississippi broadcasting all around the country. Your story is being heard by women all around the country. And if there are licensing laws in your state, ladies and gentlemen, challenge them like Melanie did. Melanie, you freed 3,000 folks from the tyranny of government in this particular instance. Thanks so much for your efforts, for your courage, and your hard work.
Thank you.
You bet. And folks, you know, this is a story we'll dig into, because it's a big problem in America. And again, Job Creators Networks brings small businesses back. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories. And in 1950, 5% of workers were required to get a license to do their job. Today, it's 50%. And so the Bring Small Businesses Back campaign by Job Creators Network, which is a plea for lower taxes, less regulation, and more access to capital, is something we'll be covering here on Our American Stories. And we're going to be hearing from people like Melanie Armstrong, the backbone of the American economy, being held back by their own government. More after this with Our American Stories.
Every day, nothing seemed to change. Everywhere I go, I keep saying the same old thing. Take it no more. Oh, I'd leave this town, but I ain't got nowhere else to go now. Wake up in the morning, more bad news, and sometimes I feel.
This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and now it's time for our This Day in History segment brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, and so much more. In this feature, you're about to meet someone you've definitely heard of, but likely don't truly know.
Although Canada is not a monarchy, this man is considered their prince. He dominated a sport for 20 years without any of the physical skills needed to even play in the National Hockey League. Yet he is known as the Great One.
A 3-on-1 Edmonton break back to Gretzky. He scores!
He's hockey's biggest star and a Canadian hero, but he's also the husband of an American. He married actress Janet Jones in 1988 and became a U.S. citizen soon after. Wayne Gretzky, born January 26, 1961, played 20 seasons in the National Hockey League. He is the leading scorer in NHL history, with more goals and more assists than any other player. Think about this. He tallied more assists than any other player has scored in total points. That's goals and assists combined. And he is the only NHL player to total over 200 points in one season, a feat he accomplished four times. Gretzky was born and raised in Brantford, Ontario. Each year, when the cold set in, his backyard was converted into a private hockey rink. Day, night, and countless pre-dawns, a frail, undersized boy practiced while his father watched through the kitchen window, drinking coffee and issuing drills that looked like they came more from a chess instructor than a hockey coach. Pure talent and desire lifted the prodigy to organized hockey at the age of six. From there, it was a short leap for full coast-to-coast fame. Here's Gretzky's biographer, Rick Riley.
He lived a life like none of us can imagine. He could skate before he could walk. And he became this sort of human icon in Canada at 10 years old. He was swamped by other 10-year-olds for autographs. By 13, he was on National Hockey Night in Canada. So he's grown up sort of like John F. Kennedy Jr. He's been the Prince of Canada.
How could this young kid achieve such success in a country where every kid is born with skates on their feet? Take a look at these numbers given to us by Jim Taylor of the Calgary Sun.
In his 9- and 10-year-old year, he scored 195 goals. And the people in the town said, yeah, well, Whitley gets in the next year, he'll never score 195 again. And they were right. The next year, he scored 378.
From an early age, the Great One earned his nickname, not just for his on-ice superiority, but also for his off-ice humility. Here's his childhood buddy, Brian Rosetto.
I used to come home and I'd score a goal and I'd be doing cartwheels, and he'd come home and they'd win 13-1. I'd say, how'd you do? He says, we won. I says, you get any goals? Yeah. How many? 11. And that's the way he was.
When Gretzky turned 14, he began playing in the minor leagues with guys who were in their 20s, and he dominated there too. Despite his unimpressive stature, strength, and speed, Gretzky's intelligence and reading of the game were unrivaled. He was adept at dodging checks from opposing players, and he could consistently anticipate where the puck was going to be and execute the right move at the right time.
Here's a kid that weighed 170 pounds soaking wet. If you got into an arm wrestling competition, you could probably drag a couple of girls out of the stands that would beat him.
Gretz was not that fast. In fact, he was slow and not that strong. In fact, he was weak, you know, and not that big. In fact, he was tiny. He was always dead last in the conditioning drills. He benched 140. I mean, you almost don't need barbells. You know, you just do the bar.
I said, this guy looks like an anorexic rock star. He's the least athletic looking person. These little pipe cleaner arms.
But there was something about him that he just had this sixth sense. He knew people. He could see shadows. He could feel movement. He said it was almost like having deja vu all the time.
The average guy in the league thinks one play ahead. The superstars think two plays ahead. And Gretzky thinks three plays ahead.
In 1978, he signed with the Indianapolis Racers of the World Hockey Association, where he briefly played before being traded to the Edmonton Oilers. As an Oiler, he established many scoring records and led his team to four Stanley Cup championships. Then Wayne met wife Janet at a Los Angeles Lakers game in 1987, and on July 16, 1988, married in a lavish ceremony at St. Joseph's Basilica that was broadcast live across Canada. Immediately after the wedding, Gretzky received his American citizenship. Just days after that, on August 9th, he was traded to the Los Angeles Kings.
It's the biggest trade in sports history. He wasn't a rookie. He wasn't over the hill. He was in his prime.
His trade to the Kings had an immediate impact on the team's performance, eventually leading them to the 1993 Stanley Cup Finals. And he is credited with popularizing hockey across the United States. Let's take a look back at his trade to the Los Angeles Kings. Canada lost their prince, but America received the sun.
Here in Los Angeles, nobody cares about anything, let alone hockey. But all of a sudden, the right people were going, and it was the in thing to do.
We were bringing Ronald Reagan before the games to give us pep talks. I mean, Sylvester Stallone came before the game to give us pep talks.
What an impact it made on this team. The sale of jackets, caps, jerseys went from dead last to number one of all sports teams.
A succession of star-studded sellouts more than doubled the value of the franchise as the Kings won their first playoff series in 7 years, beating the once-indomitable Oilers. In a single season, Wayne Gretzky sold ice hockey to a city built on sand.
He reinvented the Los Angeles Kings and got Hollywood and media corporations involved and interested in hockey, which has carried over until today.
Wayne going to Los Angeles not only saved hockey in California, it saved the NHL.
Gretzky played briefly for the St. Louis Blues before finishing his career with the New York Rangers. His retirement in the Big Apple was a heavy-hearted goodbye that was felt across the world. Here's a look back.
Gretzky looking, Yari Curry, McSorley, to Gretzky!
Gretzky is the Babe Ruth of his sport. Gretzky as an individual stood above his contemporaries to an even greater extent than did Michael Jordan.
If you compare a statistic to any other sports, I mean, you know, somebody would have to come next year and hit 95 home runs or something like that. This is definitely the greatest player that ever played the game.
You could almost see a smile come on his face the minute he stepped on the ice. Because that's where he could be, Wayne Gretzky, do what he enjoyed the most.
I think what Gretz did for hockey can never be forgotten. He changed the game. He gave it grace. He gave it space. He gave it speed. He gave it artistry. The further he gets from us, the more we'll see what he did never be accomplished again.
He basically took a league on his shoulders and carried them to a place that nobody, and I mean nobody, 20 years ago would ever have thought hockey would be right now.
He was the last hockey player who came from the game that was part of us.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll now say these words for the last time ever in this building. Hockey fans, tonight's first star,
number 99, Wayne Gretzky.
I've always said that. And I'm not the first person to say this, but he's always been a better person than he has been a hockey player. When you really get to know him, then you know why they call him the Great One.
At the time of his retirement in 1999, Wayne held 61 NHL records. Today he holds 60. After his retirement, he was immediately inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame, making him the most recent player to have the waiting period waived. The NHL retired his jersey number 99 league-wide, making him the only player to receive this honor. Wayne and Janet have 5 children and now reside in Thousand Oaks, California, where just a few years ago, their son played on the same Oaks Christian High School football team with both Joe Montana and Will Smith's boys.
Gretzky took it away from him. Gretzky moving in. He's got it! Gretzky, 77th of the year. Gretzky has pulverized another National Hockey League record.
He's made the record book obsolete, said former Minnesota general manager Lou Nanny. His only point of reference is himself. Wayne Gretzky. This day in history.
And that was just a great piece. It's Greg Hengler doing the honors. Grace, speed, artistry. And I love that line in the piece. He was always a better person than a hockey player. That tells you a lot. It actually touches you. And I had seen him play a few times in Madison Square Garden. It was the thrill of a life, and I wasn't even a hockey fan. And they say Michael Jordan changed basketball, but he had a lot of help. Larry Bird, Magic Johnson. There were all kinds of guys who revived basketball in the 1980s. But Gretzky truly did something in the NHL that no other athlete, I believe, has ever done for a single sport. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we love to bring you greatness, always, when we can. Wayne Gretzky, the life. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we like to bring you reports about all kinds of things in life. And tonight, we bring you a story from AAAR Shanto, our roving food correspondent. Take it away, AAR.
Have you ever wondered how the food television genre started? I'm AAR Shanto with Our American Stories. Today we sit down with what I dubbed, well, the godfather of the foodie television movement, Mr. Graham Kerr. And for all of you millennials that watch the Master Chefs, the Iron Chef, the Food Network, at the time that this gentleman began his career, there was no food television at all. And that's one of the things that I asked Mr. Kerr when we sat down to interview him for Our American Stories.
I was in the Air Force in New Zealand. And, you know, it's a long story before getting there, so we don't want to bother with that. Mm. And they came in to me one day and they said, we want you to go on telly. And I said, excuse me? Telly. But there isn't any television. Well, there will be next month. Well, why me? Well, the physical instructor sprained his ankle, and they wanted somebody on Battle of Britain Day, and so he couldn't do his physical jerk, so you're going to have to go on and cook something. The Air Force thought I was terrific. Apparently, so did the TV critic. There were, by the way, only 50 television sets in the whole nation. There was only one channel, and it came on at 6 and went off at 10. And I was between Peyton Place and the Avengers.
Now that Graham Kerr has started his TV debut, well, his wife, Trina, she wasn't really excited about all the things he was doing.
First of all, she said, I could care less about food. I'm not in the least bit interested in food. You give me the first 6 minutes, and then you can do your food thing. So I said, yes. Well, what happens first? You run in front of a live audience. You're really good with live people. And so you don't just want to look steadily at a camera. You want people all around you as you're cooking. Mm-hmm. So you run and you shake them by the hand. You grab a glass of wine. Yeah. And then you jump over a dining room chair. And then you tell a joke. I can't. Wow. What's the point? What is the point of a joke if the whole idea of the program is food? She said, it is so as to relax you and relax your audience and have a good laugh, and then you can cook.
Wow.
So she got the first 6 minutes. And she said, you know, really, television is not about information. It is about entertainment.
Yeah.
And you must entertain first before you inform.
And that, my friends, is how the Galloping Gourmet got its start. You see, the person I'm speaking of is known as the Galloping Gourmet. His television show became one of the biggest cooking shows ever on television. Over the years, Graham had much success. He was on Johnny Carson. He was on David Letterman. He's been on Rachel Ray. He's been on the Food Network. Graham Kerr, the Galloping Gourmet, has made a name for himself with the help of his lovely wife, Trina. These days, you'll find Graham Kerr still cooking in front of a camera, going on shows, but his newest project is focusing on his life and trying to help others find their place in their life.
We call it Flash of Silver, and I was watching one day in a local river. I live up in the northwest of the United States, in the Pacific Northwest, and I watched a Chinook, which is called a king salmon, making its way upstream against some pretty white water, and it's throwing itself at this white water with such vigor. And I knew enough about salmon to know that this salmon was within weeks of the end of its life.
Yes.
It was probably a 7 or 8 years old about that stage. And I looked at that and I had this idea in my mind, I hope that when I get to the end stretch of the river of my life, that I can throw myself at adversity with that kind of vigor.
Wow.
With that kind of determination. And from that time on, I began to start to inquire after the entire life cycle of a Chinook salmon. And I began to see that there were elements in that life cycle that were extraordinarily like all of us as human beings. And I know, I don't know anybody else who's ever compared a fish with a human. I know it's wild. And my wife, Gina, said, really? I don't think so. Yeah. And but on Rite of Passage number 5, she said, I have grown to love these fish.
Wow.
And I really know what you're getting at now. So have you heard of the book Pilgrim's Progress?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not daring to suggest that in any form comparing it, except I must. It's an extended metaphor,
yeah,
is what I have done. And I have the thought that it may just, it won't compete with that, but it may just find its own place, and people will be amazed about how it actually begins to speak into their life.
As you can see, Mr. Kerr is still changing the lives of many. He changed the lives of many on television with his cooking, and now he's changing the life of people, letting them know that age makes no difference. I'm A.A.R. Shanto with Our American Stories.
A.A.R., great job, and I call you A.A.A.R. sometimes just in jest. But A.A.R. does our food beat, and I remember the Galloping Gourmet, and so do so many Americans, and it's good to see he's doing what those salmon are doing. He's out there, and he's still working, and he's still putting himself forward for the American people, telling stories, and, well, entertaining us. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Go to Our American Network to catch all of our material. Everything's up there. More after these moments. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And each day we bring you the news around the world through one through line, one subject line, and we call it Jesse's World.
A woman took a live turkey on a Delta Airlines flight for emotional support while on vacation. Jody Smalley from Seattle, Washington, was spotted using her yellow-beaked turkey, she named Easter, as a therapy pet during her two-hour flight to Salt Lake City. After the plane touched down, she lovingly pushed the feathered creature through the airport in a wheelchair before taking it to her brother's house. Miss Smalley says her turkey offers her comfort and reminds her on a daily basis there's a reason to smile and to care no matter how bad things are. The turkey was allowed to travel on the flight under the Air Carrier Access Act of 1968, which legally permits customers to fly with emotional support animals. The turkey sighting comes nearly a year after a 29-year-old woman was escorted off a U.S. Airways flight when her emotional support pig started defecating on the floor and squealing loudly. Bull crap might not be worth much, but bull semen is another story. $50,000 worth of bull semen was recently stolen out of a truck in Turlock, California. You heard that right. Bull semen. So why on earth is it worth so much, you might ask? Well, this particular sperm came from the top 1% of the world's bull population, the Hugh Hefners among heifers. It holds a lot of genetic value and is used to impregnate cattle around the world. The stolen fluids in question was reportedly enough to impregnate more than 1,000 cattle, who are now utterly disappointed by this sick act of thievery. The victim of the theft, Anthony Reese, said that it took months to collect the valuable genetic material. We'd rather not imagine that process. Anyone with information regarding the missing semen is asked to call the Turlock, California Police Department. And speaking of California, motorists in Northern California have been dealing with a new kind of road hazard. Overly aggressive coyotes who may have consumed hallucinogenic mushrooms. At least two of the coyotes have been staring down motorists on Highway 1 in Marin County and striding into the road. When a driver stops to avoid hitting the stoned coyotes, they usually sniff around the car before running off. Lisa Block of the Marin County Humane Society says she's had to warn dog owners about the fly agaric mushroom, a psychoactive mushroom that grows in the area. These coyotes may have stumbled upon a stash. For Our American Stories, I'm Jesse Edwards.
That was great, Jesse. Good job. We love Jesse's World. And I'm telling you, when there are certain things, when you're doing animals, this is just, they're always the best. Hopped up coyotes in California roaming the streets. What a story. And stolen bull semen. Come on. It can't get better than that. Oh. And so we have to move from that to our this day in history today. And from the sublime to the serious, today in history, the Challenger explodes. And not too long ago, we had brought you the story of Buzz Aldrin. And we love the story of space and space travel. And today it's being done by some of our greatest entrepreneurs. And by the way, that's how we got in flight in the first place. The Wright brothers did it, not the government. Though if there is one place where some of us can agree we should spend some money on government, it might be NASA. It's one of those rare times when you'll get some Republicans and Democrats. And again, we don't do that kind of show, but it's one of those things where, my goodness, getting to the moon, what a thing to do. And what a great thing for a country to have achieved. And if there was one perhaps setback to NASA, it's that they kept doing the same thing over and over again. And some people were thinking, well, why don't we get to Mars? Buzz Aldrin thought that way. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and listen to that Buzz Aldrin segment. It's extraordinary. But on this day in history, a nation watched as the Challenger exploded. And nowadays, we are so used to our gadgets sending signals to and from space with satellite TVs and GPSs that we probably don't even think about just how wondrous any of this is, space exploration. And my goodness, have there been tragedies down that road of discovery? Read The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe. It gets it all. The ups and the downs in that industry, the deaths, the failed experiments, and the movie, I've got to tell you, one of the great movies based on a book. He got it right. Hit it out of the park. Well, on this day in history, in the year 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded in front of the nation's eyes and school kids' eyes, because everybody watched, because a school teacher was on that flight. They wanted to take an ordinary American and have an ordinary American go into space with the crew. And, well, let's bring you back to that moment on live television and the report of that fateful accident, that tragedy, at 11:39 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
This shuttle mission will launch, my God.
1:15.
There's been an explosion.
Velocity 2,900 feet per second, altitude 9 nautical miles, downrange distance 7 nautical miles.
This is not standard. This is not something that is planned, of course. I can see a solid rocket booster has broken away from Shuttle Challenger. That's what you're looking at in the middle of your screen. I cannot see the shuttle itself.
By the way, kids around the country again were watching this, horrified. And it didn't take long for the world to know. And again, imagine a day when there were only a few channels. There wasn't cable. There wasn't CNN. And at 6:30 that night on the NBC Nightly News, well, here's how it began. Again, millions of Americans tuned in, as they always did, especially on those days with fewer TV channels, and especially on such a tragic day, to see their trusted anchor. And that was Tom Brokaw.
NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw.
Good evening. Tonight from Washington, D.C. It was a nightmare, a cruel, shocking end to what everyone expected to be another triumph for the space shuttle program. The Challenger, with a school teacher and six regular astronauts on board, was consumed by a giant fireball explosion less than 2 minutes after it was launched into the bright blue Florida skies at 11:38 Eastern Time this morning. The path to space was filled with debris and with death. All seven people were killed.
The crew of seven included schoolteacher Krista McAuliffe from Concord, New Hampshire. Again, the first teacher in a space, leading classrooms across the country to tune in live, unknowingly exposing millions of children to the utter tragedy that had fallen her. And with no filter, there it was. Well, in 2011, NPR interviewed one of those teachers whose classroom was glued to that TV. Her name is Ellen McKinney, and she still is an elementary school teacher in McCall, Idaho. We take you to this really good conversation.
It was a very exciting time. We were working to learn as much as we could. We experimented with toys in space. We watched training videos that had been provided to us through NASA. We played with rockets. We had stuff exploding. It was just a really fun time.
Krista McAuliffe was the first regular person to go up in space, and sort of perfect that she would be a teacher because it would bring, in a way, all the kids along with her. Speaking before the launch, we have a clip of tape of her here. She seemed to be thinking really more about the teaching profession than the fact that she was going up in space.
I was delighted that a teacher was chosen as the first space participant because there are so many of us who have daily contact with people. And that was a very exciting thing for me, to think that teachers were finally recognized as the good communicators that they are and that they reach so many students.
Did that give an extra glamour, if you will, to being a teacher?
It did. I think it brought recognition to something that we hold near and dear to ourselves. And Krista was just such an exemplary person, and she went as a teacher.
That tape comes from a profile that I had prepared to go on the air the night of the launch, and it turned from a profile of the crew into a remembrance. Take us back to that morning.
We had divided the 600 kids in our school into half of them in the library, half of them in the gym, had television monitors at that time. And when the T-minus started, there were cheers and exuberance, and we counted down, and then it was silent. We stopped talking about what was happening. We'd been saying, now watch for the solid rocket boosters to come off. We're going to be seeing that any minute. And then they weren't happening, and then the explosion, and the kids quieted down, and we needed to tell them something's gone wrong. And they kept asking, you know, are those people dead? And we had to tell them yes. And that was probably one of the hardest things.
You bet. My dad was the superintendent of schools at the time in New Jersey. And that was not only a tough day, it was a tough week. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And when we come back, you'll hear the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, addressing a grieving nation. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And on this day in 1986, the Challenger exploded. We left off. Ronald Reagan was supposed to deliver the State of the Union address to Congress that night. But he couldn't. He wouldn't. Instead, he addressed our nation with these 648 words straight into the living rooms of America.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd planned to speak to you tonight to report on the State of the Union. But the events of earlier today have led me to change those plans. Today is a day for mourning and remembering. Nancy and I are pained to the core by the tragedy of the Shuttle Challenger. We know we share this pain with all of the people of our country. This is truly a national loss. 19 years ago, almost to the day, we lost three astronauts in a terrible accident on the ground. But we've never lost an astronaut in flight. We've never had a tragedy like this. And perhaps we've forgotten the courage it took for the crew of the shuttle. But they, the Challenger 7, were aware of the dangers, but overcame them and did their jobs brilliantly. We mourn seven heroes: Michael Smith, Dick Scobee, Judith Resnick, Ronald McNair, Ellison Onizuka, Gregory Jarvis, and Krista Mikhailoff. We mourn their loss as a nation together. To the families of the seven, we cannot bear, as you do, the full impact of this tragedy. But we feel the loss, and we're thinking about you so very much. Your loved ones were daring and brave, and they had that special grace, that special spirit that says, "Give me a challenge, and I'll meet it with joy." They had a hunger to explore the universe and discover its truths. They wished to serve, and they did. They served all of us. We've grown used to wonders in this century. It's hard to dazzle us. But for 25 years, the United States space program has been doing just that. We've grown used to the idea of space, and perhaps we forget that we've only just begun. We're still pioneers. They, the members of the Challenger crew, were pioneers. And I want to say something to the school children of America who were watching the live coverage of the shuttle's takeoff. I know it's hard to understand, but sometimes painful things like this happen. It's all part of the process of exploration and discovery. It's all part of taking a chance and expanding man's horizons. The future doesn't belong to the faint-hearted. It belongs to the brave. The Challenger crew was pulling us into the future, and we'll continue to follow them. I've always had great faith in and respect for our space program, and what happened today does nothing to diminish it. We don't hide our space program. We don't keep secrets and cover things up. We do it all up front and in public. That's the way freedom is, and we wouldn't change it for a minute. We'll continue our quest in space. There will be more shuttle flights and more shuttle crews, and yes, more volunteers, more civilians, more teachers in space. Nothing ends here. Our hopes and our journeys continue. I want to add that I wish I could talk to every man and woman who works for NASA or who worked on this mission and tell them, your dedication and professionalism have moved and impressed us for decades, and we know of your anguish. We share it. There's a coincidence today. On this day, 390 years ago, the great explorer Sir Francis Drake died aboard ship off the coast of Panama. In his lifetime, the great frontiers were the oceans, and a historian later said he lived by the sea, died on it, and was buried in it. Well, today, we can say of the Challenger crew, their dedication was, like Drake's, complete. The crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them, this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God. Thank you.
You almost tear up just hearing that. And that's what we love to do here at Our American Stories. Not a clip, the whole thing. And by the way, what a thing to tell young people. And by the way, every young kid was up watching that. I was. And I wasn't young. Love it when he said the future doesn't belong to the faint-hearted. It belongs to the brave. By the way, it might have been a very good thing for these kids to see that. We shelter our kids too much. They can get stronger from these things. And they can learn what bravery looks like. Well, a few days later, the president and the first lady flew to Houston for a memorial service. And they sat in between two of the astronauts' widows. And Reagan later recalled, quote, "I found it difficult to say anything. So all we could do is hug the families and try our best to hold back tears." Well, by the time he stood before 10,000 NASA employees, guests, and the families of the astronauts, Reagan found his voice again. After eulogizing each extraordinary member of the crew, he turned to their families and said this:
"The sacrifice of your loved ones has stirred the soul of our nation. And through the pain, our hearts have been opened to a profound truth. The future is not free. The story of all human progress is one of a struggle against all odds. We learned again that this America, which Abraham Lincoln called the last best hope of man on earth, was built on heroism and noble sacrifice. It was built by men and women like our seven star voyagers, who answered a call beyond duty, who gave more than was expected or required, and who gave it little thought of worldly reward. We think back to the pioneers of an earlier century, the sturdy souls who took their families and their belongings and set out into the frontier of the American West. Often they met with terrible hardship. Along the Oregon Trail, you can still see the grave markers of those who fell on the way. But grief only steeled them to the journey ahead. Today, the frontier is space and the boundaries of human knowledge. Sometimes when we reach for the stars, we fall short. But we must pick ourselves up again and press on, despite the pain. Our nation is indeed fortunate that we can still draw on immense reservoirs of courage, character, and fortitude, that we're still blessed with heroes like those of the Space Shuttle Challenger."
Nobody did that better than Reagan, JFK, Roosevelt, Lincoln. They knew how to stir the souls of men. No Democrat, no Republican stuff. That was their greatness. Well, there was a report that was commissioned, and, well, we know what caused it. The Challenger investigation report even had a chapter titled "An Accident Rooted in History." The failure was traced to O-ring seals in the rocket booster joints, but the real question isn't which parts failed. It's why those parts were in the boosters at all by 1986. It had turned out there had just been some bureaucratic snafus, and that's what can happen with bureaucracies. But everyone learned. Here's the quote from the report: "The space shuttle's solid rocket booster problem began with a faulty design of its joint and increased as both NASA and contractor management failed first to recognize it as a problem, then failed to fix it, and finally treated it as an acceptable flight risk." And the rest is history. And on this day in history, brought to you by Hillsdale College, the Space Challenger explosion. Let's go off with where we started.
The shuttle mission will launch. My God.
1:15.
There's been an explosion.
Velocity 2,900 feet per second. Altitude 9 nautical miles. Downrange distance 7 nautical miles.
This is not standard. This is not something that is planned, of course. I can see a solid rocket booster has broken away from Shuttle Challenger. That's what you're looking at in the middle of your screen. I cannot see the shuttle itself.
Thank you.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And if you're looking for news or hot talk, well, that's not what we do here. But we do like to talk about the things that, well, really affect most Americans, from health to the arts to, in this particular case, housing. And we came across a very good article in the Wall Street Journal from the housing reporter there. And Laura Cusisto joins us now. Thanks, Laura, for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much.
You bet. What drew you to this story, Laura? You've been covering it. You've been covering housing for one of the great papers in the United States, and this is your beat. What have you been observing, and why this particular piece, which had a headline, U.S. apartment rents leap at fastest pace since housing crisis?
Well, I think in general, everyone is very focused on home prices and home ownership, but a huge portion of the country rents, and there's a real affordability problem for a lot of those people. Rents, as we say in the article, really leaped at their fastest pace since before the recession this last year, and that's affecting people everywhere from San Francisco to New York, but also even smaller cities like Nashville, and it's a real challenge for folks.
Well, and when the housing crisis hit, it became, obviously, there were new loan requirements, new rules in place. So for a lot of folks, it became harder to qualify for mortgages. So is this a supply-demand problem in the end that's driving this spike?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few different forces that are converging. One is that it is more difficult to get a mortgage, and then you layer on top of that the fact that as rents go up, it gets harder to save for a down payment, and so that keeps folks renting even longer. You had both a combination of people who lost their homes to foreclosure who ended up renting, and then you also have younger people who are renting longer, both because of demographic changes, but also because I think people are much more hesitant to go and take on a big mortgage these days. They've seen what other people went through a decade ago. And so that's just created a much larger population of renters. And in the meantime, supply just really hasn't been catching up until the last year or so. There's been really very little construction because it's just also very hard to get a loan to build a new apartment building because we went through such a bruising real estate crash.
And let's look at some of the just sheer raw numbers, if you could, Laura. Talk about, first, the home ownership rates. They're at record lows. Give us what the highs were, what they're at now, and just give us a broader context for, A, what's going on in the home ownership world, because obviously this reflects concurrently on what's actually going on in the rental world.
Right. So I just a new homeownership rate came out today, and there's some indication that it might finally be bottoming out somewhere around 63.7%. It hasn't gone down for the last couple of quarters, but the typical homeownership rate is closer to about 65%. We were at one point up in the high 60s, and that doesn't sound like, I mean, you know, this is a percentage difference or here or there, but in the context of the whole U.S. population, we're talking of millions of people who are homeowners versus, or who are renters now, who were once homeowners. I think the expectation is that the homeownership rate will start to creep back up, but it's very unlikely we'll see it go back up to the high 60s, just because there were probably a lot of people who were buying homes then, as we know, who really shouldn't have been. So we'll continue to see a large population of renters.
Yeah, now it may be the opposite, Laura. I mean, your reporting here indicated that home ownership rates in the third quarter stood at 63.7%. And here's the kicker, nearly a 30-year low. And so, again, as you explained, these seem like little percentages, but let's just use baseball as a metaphor. One extra hit every few games turns a guy from an average player into a Hall of Famer. And so these percentages really matter. What's this been on the impact for? What impact has this been on or had on family formation and the ability for young people, particularly Laura, to step out and seek to possibly own that first home?
So, yeah, I mean, it's something of a chicken and egg question. I think people don't know if young people are less interested in owning or if they have chosen to, or if they've ended up renting and decided to like renting because they can't own. But there's no question that young people are having a tough time getting into the homeownership market. Home prices have also gone up quite a bit. There's not a lot of inventory in the market, especially inventory at the lower price points. And so you're seeing younger people rent for longer and longer. You're also seeing, again, like kind of longer historical trends, young people getting married and having children later. And so it also sort of makes sense that they might wait to buy later. You're much more likely to want to rent and stay downtown and kind of where all the cool stuff is. But I think there's absolutely concern among some economists that as house prices rise, young people have missed the chance to get in and buy when they were relatively affordable, and now it's getting very tough for them to buy in some markets.
Well, and that's the young. What about the working poor, Laura? What about the working poor?
Yeah, I think you saw a lot of those people. Those people obviously lose their homes during the foreclosure crisis, and a lot of those people ended up renting single-family homes. That was a really kind of common place for people who had a family but ended up renting. You aren't seeing so far big movements of those people who lost their homes going back and buying. There's some of that going on, but I think there are a number of different theories about why they're not. But one is that it was just sort of a very scarring experience, and that people prefer to stay renting.
Yeah, I've known quite a number of people who got burned so badly by the downturn they were overleveraged. And they're just terrified. But I know equally as many people who are in what I just call the renter's trap. And that is, mm-hmm. as rents go up, they've just got no savings left. So they can't mm-hmm. gear up for that down payment. And the banks, they want that down payment now. You're not hearing 5% down, 0% down. Those days are over.
Yeah, no, and the research bears out that both of those examples are happening for sure.
You know, one of the things I read another piece in the journal about in the apartment space, that the types of apartments that are flooding the market are for the high-end customers in cities, but that there's not been a ton of equivalent lower middle class and middle class rentals pouring into the market. Talk about that concentration since you're on the housing beat. I know it was a separate piece. I'm not sure if it was by you or not, but I saw that trend in the last week or two in the journal as well.
Yeah, so I mean, it's certainly always been the case that newer product, newer construction tends to fetch higher prices. But it also seems to be true that there's sort of statistics that support this, that that during this particular cycle, because construction costs have been high, because it's very difficult to get permits, land costs are high, projects are taking a long time to get built, that developers are really aiming product at the very, very high end. And there also seems to be demand for that. There are more professionals renting. There are more older retired couples renting who can afford those high rents, and that's been a real challenge. You're seeing much more rapid rent increases and much smaller vacancy rates in the kind of mid tier, and you're not really seeing any new construction for that, and so that's putting a particular squeeze on people who are renting those mid priced apartments.
Now, tell me in this space, give us a sense of the aggregate increases over the last, let's say, decade or so. In terms of rentals, how much more is the average rent today than it was a year ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago? Give us a context for this, Laura.
Sure. So I'll give you 5 years ago, because that's probably the best comparison. The last decade was a pretty volatile one for the housing market. But if you go 5 years back, rents are about 20% more expensive than they were 5 years ago, which is a big increase, especially if you consider that people's incomes haven't grown at nearly that rate.
No, that's a big ticket item too. So when you're talking about a 20% increase on what may be the biggest family budget item, this is going to mm-hmm. eat into a bunch of other things. And by the way, Laura, you add that in. I was in Des Moines yesterday, and I was talking to a taxi cab driver, and he couldn't give it up on both the rent increases and the increase in health care. And he just said, mm-hmm. I can't work enough hours. He was working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and so was his wife. And they said, we just can't make it. We don't think we're ever getting out of the rental situation. And my heart broke, Laura. My heart broke.
Yeah. Oh, it's a really tough. It's a really tough spot. Especially, I mean, rent is not a really. It's not a discretionary expense. So you see people cutting back on other things, cutting back on entertainment, but even, you know, clothing budgets, food budgets, especially those working class renters. It's a real challenge.
Well, you know, I'm going to leave it with this, because we all know that there is a large federal subsidy for homeowners, And this is generally one of those tax deductions that favors those who have housing. And it's a rather large subsidy. What government policy? Is there discussion in this space? We're starting to talk about this a bit here on our show. But what's happening in policy circles about this crisis in rentals, Laura?
There are certainly groups that are advocating that we take a look at the mortgage interest deduction and that we create some kind of a subsidy for renters. I'm sure you can imagine it's very controversial. I think we're a long ways off from seeing any of that materialize, but there are absolutely groups that are arguing for that. And I think on the other hand, also, you're seeing cities really step up where there isn't a lot of federal subsidy for affordable rental production. You're seeing cities try to create programs to require affordable housing, cities trying to put money in from their budgets into affordable housing, because it's really, that's where you're really seeing the impact is on the ground in cities like New York and San Francisco and Nashville. And so you're seeing them kind of try to take a bit of a lead in stimulating affordable housing production.
Well, that's great to know, and it doesn't always have to be the federal government that steps in, and that's our belief here, though it's an interesting subject. And Laura, thanks for the reporting you do for the Wall Street Journal. We'd like you to come on regularly and talk about this big and important beat.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You bet. This is Lee Habib, and once again, we talk about the things you care about, housing, the Wall Street Journal's beat reporter on the space. This is Our American Stories, and we'll be back after these messages.
Talk to Phil, Jesus, in a small town.